Hello, dear friends. Greg Kokel here. The show is Stand to Reason. And glad to be with you today talking about things that really matter. And we take it seriously at Stand to Reason to be able to assess things, reflect on things, on moral, ethical, theological issues that will help you think more carefully about the things that really matter. And we've been doing it now for over 27 years. I've been doing it for 27 years. Oh, wait a minute. Let me just think for a minute. This is my 28th year? I get them mixed up. My 27th or 28th? No, 1990. So this is my 30th year in radio. But 27 years would stand to reason. And many of you have been part of that for a long, long time. And that really satisfies me. And you contact me and you tell me about that and what you've learned. And I'm glad for that because we work hard at STR to make a difference in your life. And I just heard the ding, ding, ding of my mail. So I am going to quit the mail here so I don't hear that ding anymore. Listen, my number is 1-855-243-9975. Let me give that to you again. 855-243-9975. That's the number you can call. Anytime, as long as it's Tuesdays from 4 to 6 p.m. Pacific time. And most of those times, you will get yours truly. And I'll be glad and happy to talk with you about anything that's on your mind in the areas of ethics, values, and religion. Of course, my goal at Stand to Reason is to provide a defense for classical Christianity and classical Christian values. I think and am convinced that Christianity is simply the best explanation for the way things are. There's tremendous explanatory power in the Christian worldview. And one of the ways that I've expressed that, by the way, is in a book that I wrote a couple years ago, The Story of Reality. Many of you know about the book. The subtitle being How the World Began, How It Ends, and Everything Important that happens in between. One reason I bring it up now is just a couple of days ago, I actually completed the final edit for the workbook for that book, for Zondervan. We already have a full video series out with Zondervan, and we will be making that. That is available now, I guess. Or maybe they're releasing it when they release the workbook at the same time in a couple of months. So I can't remember what their actual schedule is. But basically, the workbook, and I've already not only written it and sent it in, but they sent the galleys back to me, and I made some minor changes and copy edits that are kind of the very final stage before they go to press and put it into play. But there's about 150 pages there in more or less outline form. So if you want to get the whole story of reality, in a certain sense, light or quickly, the main issues, the main elements, then the workbook is the way to go. And that will be available through Zondervan and also through Stand to Reason, I'm pretty sure. Derek, we'll be carrying that. Yeah, he's nodding to me there. But it's just another way that we are able to give you foundational equipping. And it's not what I plan to talk about this morning. I have another point that I want to get to in a moment. But I want to emphasize how important foundational equipping is. And maybe next hour I'll talk about it a little bit when I discuss how preachers mispreach much of the time from the text and end up teaching not the text but something completely unrelated to the text they're citing, and therefore they're no longer preaching the text, and therefore their preachments have no authority if the authority comes from the meaning of the text itself. I'll talk about that later, but the consequence in my view of these kinds of things is that Christians are not well rooted in the foundation. And I'll tell you, I've been working on, been building on that foundation and focusing on the basics and the foundation for closing in on 50 years now. And I think the foundations are pretty cool. I don't think we have to get creative, to put it simply, and expand on it and find new things. In theology, revealed theology from a book that's 2,000 years old plus, finding new things is not generally a good idea. if the church in 2,000 years, the people of God, or the Jewish people before them have not found it, it's probably not in there, okay? Which is one of the reasons the new wave of theology regarding homosexuality that many Christians like Matthew Vines and the Reformation Project are advancing or have been advancing, one of the reasons why this one is, these things are obviously misdirected, because at the heart of their enterprise is the implicit claim that for thousands of years, the body of believers, whether Jewish earlier on or followers of Jesus explicitly after Jesus, have gotten it wrong. They've just misunderstood. And now thousands of years later, removed from the culture, removed from the language, removed from the geography, some people think they've figured it out when God's people over thousands of years have gotten it mistaken. So that's probably not a good situation. You don't want to get novel. You don't want to find something new. You want to stick with the basics. That I do for the moment. I got a lot more to talk about, but I got lots of callers on too. So let me take a quick break and we'll get to your calls right here on Stand to Reason.
Some people treat Christianity like it's a build-your-own Sunday shop. They include the bits they like and exclude the bits they don't. The problem is, truth is not ice cream. You can't build your own biblical reality like you build an ice cream sundae. You can't pick and choose the parts you prefer. Truth doesn't work like that. Truth is what matches up with reality. Sadly, there are some who are creating a version of Christianity that fits their own subjective desire rather than sound doctrine. At this year's STR Reality Conferences, you will get the tools to identify counterfeit versions of Christianity so you can guard against them. We want to show you that biblical reality isn't something we shape, rather, it's something that shapes us. So join us at one of this year's STR Reality Conferences. Discover why truth is not ice cream by visiting realityapologetics.com and registering today.
You know, if you've gained anything from listening to Stand to Reason, I'd really be thrilled to hear it from you. I love to take your questions, of course, but I also want your feedback. So here's what you can do. Head over to iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave us a rating and a review. That kind of thing really helps us to get the word out so more ambassadors for Christ can find the show and become equipped to stand confidently. And you never know, I might just give you a shout out on the air to show you my appreciation for your positive review. I value you as a faithful listener. I look forward to reading what you think about the show. Thanks. All righty, back at you here. Stand to Reason, Greg Kokel, your host. As I want to say as usual, but lately I've had some replacements, which have been fine. And I'm grateful for people who take over for me when I'm not able to be here. Hey, let's go to the calls then. This is Jordan in Georgia. Hello, Jordan.
Hey, Greg. How you doing?
Doing all right. Thank you. Good.
The pretty big mishap you had there. I was on the line. I was like sitting here for 10 minutes with just music on the phone. I was like, what's going on? Did I do something wrong?
No, what happened is we had a little glitch and I went off the air and I was talking for about 15 minutes to myself. And so it took a little while for us to kind of get things squared away and to back up a little bit and decide just to bring in callers right now. So here you go.
All righty. Well, my question sort of involves children in foster care and same-sex parents. When it comes to one or the other, what is your stance on the one that is better or worse and reasons for why that is?
Well, this is a hard one to answer because both categories, foster care and same-sex couples, are variables. Some foster care is fabulous. Some foster care is deplorable. Some same-sex couples are fabulous. Some same-sex couples are deplorable. And actually, the same is true for heterosexual couples. Now, of course, same-sex couples have an additional element added to whatever circumstances that that they have as parents and the domestic situation, that is a concern to me, and that is their same sex relationships being characterized as appropriate, normal, and in that circumstance you have two fathers or two mothers, you don't have a father and a mother, okay? So I'm not embarrassed by saying that I think there is a moral concern with the kind of relationship that is being portrayed in a same-sex family, just as much as I have a concern about heterosexual couples that are living on and off together who have children by that relationship but are not married. Okay, this communicates something on a moral basis that I think is a problem for the children. But there are other things that may be really good, or other things that may be bad. So this is there are a number of factors that are involved here. So all things being equal, let me just put it this way, all things being equal, and of course that's never the case, but what I'm trying to do is isolate out the issue of same-sex versus heterosex couples for child rearing. All things being equal, I think it is better for heterosexual couples to raise children rather than same-sex couples. Why would I say that? You can look at it two ways. You could look at it from a naturalistic way or a theistic way. Naturalistically, that's because nature determined that way. That's the natural pattern, and it's probably the natural pattern for a good reason, all right, because it's better that way. If you want to look at it theologically, which is the way I look at it, which I think is the underlying reality, is God made it that way. God made men, a man to be with a woman to have children so that the brood, has a father and a mother, because a father brings something different to the relationship than a mother does. Period. This is as obvious as the day is long. I've just been thinking about it the last couple days, for example, here at home. I have two daughters and a female wife, obviously, and two female cats. One male cat, he's not much help. I got a lot of estrogen around here. And when my daughter has her friends come over, and there were two over yesterday, they go a little wacko and wild. And what does my wife do? She encourages it, which actually is pretty good. Because it's good for my daughters to enjoy each other and get a little wild. Now, what I do, I'm dad. I like standards and order and stuff like that. And instead of being the protective influence, making sure the kids have a good time, I want to be I want to be pushing them to do things that they don't like to do. Clean up that mess. Take care of that thing. It's bedtime. Everybody goes to bed. That kind of stuff. So mothers, generally speaking, offer something different than fathers offer, generally speaking, and both are really important. If you have same-sex couples, you are designing a circumstance that denies a child or children that benefit. Okay. Now, somebody might say, oh, well, show me the scientific evidence. I don't need scientific evidence, nor do most people who have a reasonably common sense view of reality and can observe their world. Mothers and fathers provide different things, period. Okay, and a kid needs both of them, and there's a balance out for that. This is another. This is a reason, by the way, just to show that I'm not unfairly prejudiced here, why I don't believe that single people ought to adopt. Because there you're engineering the same kind of circumstance. You're engineering a circumstance where a child doesn't have a full complement of parents. Now, when my wife was a single mom when I married her. Some people find themselves in a circumstance like that because of the circumstances of death or immorality or something like that, and they do the best they can, and a lot of single parents do a fabulous job, but they know it's not ideal. So right. What we want to do is try to make decisions based on the ideal, okay? And the ideal is a mother and father. Actually, the ideal is a good mother and father. And in the foster care system, there are many saints. I've met a bunch of them. people who are just unbelievable in their sacrificial approach to parenting and the prices they pay to deal with what are often troublesome children coming out of the foster care system. And plus, they invest in them for years and then may lose them back to the system or to the parents that didn't do such a good job in the first place. So there's some amazing people there, but there are also people that are in it for the money and they pay little attention to the kids and there's abuse that slips through the system and all kinds of stuff like that. This is why it's hard to make a judgment. Are children in foster care better off with same-sex couples or better off staying in foster care? And so it depends on the individual circumstance. I would rather see a child in a reasonably healthy environment with a same-sex couple than in an abusive environment with a heterosexual couple. But these are all judgments that have to be made kind of on the run. And the big issue is, the big thing is what's best for the kid, and another detail that you have to consider in what's best for the kid is heterosexual parents are better than same-sex parents on balance, all things being equal. And that is a bias that people might say I'm bringing it's a prejudice, you know, you're judging, and well, it's not a prejudice. It's not a prejudgment. It's a judgment based on facts, common sense facts. Okay. So is it discriminatory? Of course it's discriminatory. We always discriminate in decisions we make, and sometimes the discriminations are right ones. And this is an example of that, just the same way as I would discriminate against a single person who wanted to adopt. However, if this child had no parent whatsoever and was living in the squalor in the street somewhere, it's better for that child to be with a single parent than where they're at. And so that's why the circumstances taken as a whole need to be taken into consideration.
I see, because I was in a discussion with a friend about this for a couple weeks ago, and she was pretty adamant that she would rather a same-sex couple adopt a child and they'd be safe and healthy there than in a deplorable situation in the foster care system. And I was kind of leaning towards the idea that there's a lot of negative outcomes and effects for living in a same-sex parent household for children, and I didn't know if those necessarily would outweigh being in a foster care system, but I know that there are a lot of variables there.
Yeah, and I think that's the key, the variables. However, that's why I said all things being equal, and I think it's wrong, flat-out bad policy. It ignores common sense to, in the foster care system, to treat same-sex couples act exactly the same as heterosexual couples. They shouldn't, because heterosexual couples bring something more to the parenting environment than same-sex couples bring. And therefore, there's an advantage to being with heterosexual, like you said, all things being equal, than same-sex couples.
Right. So, but at the end of the day, if push came to shove, it would be better for them to be with a same-sex couple if the conditions in the foster care were absolutely horrid for them.
Yes. What is the better circumstance, all things considered? Is there a liability with same-sex couples? Yes. But it may be minor compared to the liability of staying in an abusive situation in the foster care system. Something like that. All right. Okay. You got to start with the standards and work from the standards to the circumstances that you're faced with. That's what I'd say. Fair enough?
Okay. That sounds good. Thanks,
right.
Greg. I appreciate it.
Okay, you're welcome, Jordan. I appreciate that, too. Let's go to Rebecca in Arizona. Hello, Rebecca.
Hi, Greg. How are you?
I'm doing okay. Is it hot there right there in Arizona right now?
Yeah, I think it was 118 the other day.
Oh, my gosh. I have never – let me just think. I think it's been 118 once in the Central Valley when I was going to Hume Lake one summer. I'm driving there with my daughters, and we kept looking at the temperature, and it kept going up and up and up and up. But, whoa, that's hot.
Yeah, it's
no fun. you're indoors, and so that's a good place to be when it's 118 in Arizona. So what's on your mind?
Well, first, I just wanted to genuinely thank you for all the work you've done. You're so right that people don't understand how not understanding the foundation of what they believe is now starting to take them captive. And I'm so grateful for your tactics in defending the faith. My husband introduced that to me, and it really helped me to solidify my faith in Christ. And so I'm just very grateful to you
Thank
for that.
Thank you. You're very welcome.
I've been reading a lot lately, my husband and I, in different areas, everything from politics to Chinese espionage and academia playing out in society to, you know, the coronavirus, how it got here. What's really stood out to me is all of these prophetic postings that have been going on. There's different pastors that are posting different things on dreams that they're having within days of each other, people confirming things they're saying. There's, I think, a Christian lady who worked for FEMA for 20 years who quit because of the government plans to combine vaccines with biological warfare, CRISPR, computer technology, all of this stuff. Maybe it's the mark of the beast, like all of these things coming out. And I guess my question really has to do what evidence in the world indicates how we can tell if we're approaching end times, and how can we discern the right information to listen to in this deceptive nature of media now, and how do we know if it relates to end times or Revelation or any of the prophecies that have been spoken?
Right. Okay. Written. Sure. I'm glad you called about this, and you may not be too satisfied with my response. Let me give you a little personal history here. I became a Christian in 1973. My very first Bible study that I ever went to in October of 73 was taught by Hal Lindsey, who had just gotten back from the 1973, Six-Day War. That had just happened, and he was just in Israel. And Hal Lindsey, as many know, was the author of The Late Great Planet Earth that traded in these concepts very aggressively. And then I lived in the community there where that Bible study was being held for 2.5 years. And so all of my early teaching as a Christian was focused on this approach to the idea of end times. Okay. And in fact, it was so taught that the intensity was such that a lot of the single guys, including me at the time, were thinking, oh, man, I hope Jesus doesn't come back before the rapture doesn't happen before I get married, you know. And so we had this thing called the rapture rush, you know, people wanting to get married quickly, so to speak, you know, so they get married before the rapture kind of deal. Anyway, now that was almost close to 50 years ago, all right, 47 years ago. And none of the things that we expected were about to happen the next day or week or month took place. In fact, the world polity has changed radically since then. And so, and also, as I've studied, my own views have changed in some degree. Like, I'm not a rapture guy anymore, and I have reasons for that, and that would be another discussion. But and usually the question you ask is based on the idea that we are moving pell-mell towards the final 7 years, which will be inaugurated by the disappearance of the church from the earth in what's called the rapture. And then there'll be 3.5 years of peace and 3.5 years of tribulation, then Jesus returns. Ironically, I was listening to a talk last night with my wife that John MacArthur was giving about the identity or about the person of the Antichrist. And it was really interesting. It was all this same kind of stuff, John MacArthur being a strong pre-trib, pre-millennial person when it comes to prophecy, as are all the Calvary Chapels and many evangelicals. Now, I tend to be pre-millennial still in my overall view, but this morning I finished reading the book of Revelation. I've been reading for the last week and a half or 2 weeks or so. And at 47 years as a Christian, with all the things I've been exposed to, blah, 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 this and that, I'm still reading it saying, man, this is a confusing book. And I know about the connections to Daniel and Ezekiel and Zechariah and all these other, I know about those connections. I know about the man of perdition and the Antiochus Epiphanes and 444 BC, you know, the decree of Artaxerxes to rebuild the temple. I know all of that stuff. But even so, with all that information, I'm still going, huh? And so I personally now am not, I don't have any really strong convictions about that issue that you asked about. Okay? Are things getting worse? Yeah, they're getting worse. But there have been lots of times in history when things got really bad for Christians and for the world. And it made Christians wonder, gee, is the return of Christ just around the corner? This is just a matter of historical fact. And in fact, Jesus didn't come then. Things changed, things got better, things got worse, new people came into power, and then there were new ideas about how these prophecies would ultimately be fulfilled. Do you know that in the 60s in Brussels, there was this massive computer that was called the Beast, nicknamed the Beast? And of course, we all took that as, wow, can you believe it? There, it's happening right now. Now, that massive computer in the 60s, that would be mid-70s, in Brussels, probably can fit inside of an iPhone now. But there is a tendency to interpret current events in a way that fits our predisposition about how we think end times are going to unravel or unroll or unfold or whatever. I just don't do that anymore. And the reason I don't do that is it's not helpful, I think. I think the interpretation, let me back up. I think the fulfillment will be the final interpretation. Let me say it again. The fulfillment is the final interpretation. We see this in the life of Jesus, where there is a lot of Old Testament references that were kind of obscure, but after they were fulfilled in Jesus, we can kind of see how it all ties together. But that predisposition to believe one way about Messiah was a stumbling block for the Jews during the time of Jesus. And I think now maybe that could be the case for a lot of Christians. A lot of Christians think they're going to be rescued from hardship by the rapture. This is not going to happen. Even if there is a rapture in the way they think it is, Christians for 2,000 years have not been rescued from hardship or persecution. And in fact, just reading the book of Revelation, chapter 14? Can't remember for sure. But right there in the middle somewhere, there's all these saints who have been martyred, their blood shed for the Lamb. They did not love their life even unto the death, kind of thing. And so regardless of what one's end time eschatology convictions happen to be, Christians are going to suffer in all ages. And so we're not going to escape that. What we ought to be thinking about doing, in my view, is how can I develop a solid, sound, virtuous life, a faithful life, because faithfulness is key in the book of Revelation, those who are faithful to the end. How can I do that now in the midst of whatever it is that I'm facing? And how can I fulfill my God-ordained responsibilities to be useful in the body of Christ and be a light to the world and to fulfill the Great Commission, which is a discipleship commission? So in my life, Rebecca, I'm not trying to do those calculations, to be honest with you. I don't even know how to do them. And many of the times in the past when those efforts have been undertaken, they just have not borne fruit. They just resulted in a lot of chaos and hard feelings or whatever, arguments. I mean, I used to argue all the time with people when I was in a nasty way, in an unpleasant way, when I was a fairly new Christian about issues like this. So I've just backed off on it. It may be that, there's one sense in which we are in the end times, because strictly speaking, the end times is a term of art that is theologically identifying the time between Jesus' first coming and the second coming. So the end times is the church age. Just like it says in Hebrews, in these end times God has spoken through his Son. So now end times doesn't mean like 2 weeks or a month or 7 years. In this case, it appears to be going on for 2,000 years, but it is a theological period. Now, what you're talking about is the end of the end times. And to be honest, I don't know if we're at that. I have no way of knowing. So maybe when those things happen very explicitly, then when those who are observant will see, there it is, clearly, right there. There's the man of perdition setting himself up in the Holy of Holies and declaring himself God, like Antiochus Epiphanes did in 200 BC. So, but other than that, I don't know. I don't spend a lot of energy on that. What I try to do is try to be faithful with what I know I'm supposed to be doing. That's the key, for me at least. I don't know if that helps, Rebecca. That maybe that's a really disappointing answer.
Yeah, I mean, it helps. You're absolutely right. I don't think that we shouldn't be focused on what we should be doing. It's just difficult to discern what's going on in the media and if we should even be paying attention to those things. I know that right now it's just inciting a lot of fear in people. So they're kind of glued to their television sets instead of glued to praying and praying to the Lord. But
I think it is inciting a lot of fear, and I think it's going to get harder for Christians before it gets better, much, much harder. And things have really taken a turn in the last couple of months for the worse. That is, a trend is in place that does not bode well for Christians. I mean, when rioters can riot without wearing masks, and that's okay to the governor or the mayor of New York City, but Christians can't get together for church, that tells you something is going on. Anyway, thank you for the call, Rebecca. I really appreciate that.
Thank you, Greg.
You're welcome. I wish I had more to say about it, but anyway. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven, my friends. In the midst of it all, give them heaven. Bye-bye.